Isn't it funny how the best chats are often had in the car on a long drive? Yeah, you're swapping stories, you're having a laugh, and you're solving the world's biggest problems. So welcome to Car Chats, where we put you in the back seat and get the backstory of some of our favorite humans and hopefully learn something along the way. Okay, so this was an incredibly fun episode with one of my play mentors, a play icon you might say, the one and only Hamish Blake. In part one of this two-part episode, we discuss Hamish's philosophy of life, leadership, and love. To access video highlights from this episode, download the Mojo Crow app, where you'll find a whole world of stories and helpful content to help you navigate life. Head to mojocrow.com/membership to find out more. Okay, now to part one of this episode with Hamish, and I hope you enjoy the chat as much as I enjoyed taking him for a ride. So I got to ask, the correlation between 2 days after creating the world's first solvable cake and Sunny potentially being not feeling too well today.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
totally coincidence, yeah.
Luckily, he did mention some of the symptoms that he is now properly staying home. He's sick from school with. He did have a hint of it. At footy that morning, the morning of his birthday party.
Yep.
You know, talked to him. He was like, no, I'm fine. I think I'm good. I feel great. Running around, having a time of his life.
Yep.
So thankfully, because there were some questionable ingredients in that cake. One of them was lube, like personal lube. But that was to make the plastic rotate. You know, the lube wasn't in the cake.
Technically.
Yeah. It was more just me trying to pick a lubricant that should it accidentally get near cake is both food safe, edible, and has a flavour.
Yeah.
And that's why I got tiramisu lube.
Yeah, strategic lube.
So there was a worry that it was lube poisoning, but I looked up no instances ever of anyone being lube poisoned. Even if you ate heaps and heaps of it.
According to Dr. Google.
It's water soluble. Yeah. It's one of their big ads. You're gonna eat tubes of this and you'll be fine.
Okay, so he's doing all right.
He's doing all right.
Okay. So the reason for Crowy Car Chats, or Car Chats with Crow. We actually don't have a name yet.
This is good.
You're only the third person in the car. We created Mojo Espresso during COVID just to literally help people.
Yep.
Because there were so many people stressed and anxious and worried. And it kind of took off, created a whole kind of world of its own. And it was really just designed to have this caffeine-inspired shot of inspiration, hence your macchiato.
I love it.
To help people kind of win the morning, win the day, right? So anyway, I thought...
I think it's a great idea.
What if we did something different? And an old client of mine, a very old friend of mine too, Andre Agassi, was asking me for parental advice once.
Jeez.
Which is kind of relevant to the podcast you've just created, right? And anyway, I said, look, it's above my pay grade, but you've got to speak to my wife, Sally. Like, she's amazing. And he had two teenagers. So we had dinner in Melbourne a few years ago, fancy restaurant, round table, and he deliberately made Sally sit next to him, and she rocked up late to the dinner, and before she'd even sat down, Andre's just into her. Like, she had issues with, you know, chatting to teenage kids, whatever it is. So what's your advice? What's your number one advice for having a crucial conversation with kids? And like, Sally's never met Andre before. She's going, could I just have a glass of wine before we get into these kind of life-altering conversations? And anyway, so she sat down, got a glass of wine. And the first thing she said to Andre says, do you have a dog? And he goes, yeah, I've got two dogs. She goes, okay, no worries. Go for a walk with your kids with the dog. So there's something about walking with a dog.
That's good.
It's unconditional love. So the second thing is, go for a drive in the car. He goes, why? He goes, what? She goes, well, there's something incredibly safe about taking your kids, especially teenage kids, for a drive in the car. There's like this... You don't have to make eye contact
with
much, so they feel very safe, very warm.
This is great advice.
You're also moving forward, kind of physically, but also
you're achieving something.
Yep. Yeah, exactly right. You're also kind of, because you're both looking out in the world, you're kind of tapping into your imagination, kind of.
Yeah, I like that.
Which is that kind of right brain curiosity to problem solve
issues pondering.
And so forth.
Yeah.
You're kind of pondering, yeah.
We can just do a Yui here because we've come to the end of the rope.
And... not only that, she didn't say this at the time, it was a big one for me later on when I started doing the work that we do, is it's often someone's earliest, happiest memory.
Is it really?
Yeah, I asked someone, okay, well, tell me...
Do you know what? It is, because it is for me too. I was doing this, I was talking to my psychologist a year ago, but it always stuck in my head where we sort of did this, like, what's your earliest?
Yeah.
What's a early happy child? Any, like, pick one.
So what
and
is,
you think they're random, but yeah. I was just sitting in the car with my dad, sitting in the ute with my dad, and I guess I was just tagging along because I would have been 6 or 7.
Yep.
And I was just tagging along to him to go to the farm because he was working on a farm. And it just, like, dad's ute was just, like, filthy. I have never seen a car like it before or since. I thought it was the norm growing up, but it was like the passenger seat where it was just full of tools. And and it would have been like an archaeological dig the closer you got to the floor mats. Like, there would be tools in there from like 30 years ago, like just dust and dirt and stuff.
You might need it one day.
Yeah, so it was just this, it wasn't like a hoarder or anything. It was just a traveling shed that you, but you know, the
what did your dad do?
Ripped off. So he worked for my mum's dad at that time. My mum's dad had a couple of farms, like cattle farms, like not too far from, and market gardens, not too far from Melbourne.
Right.
And then he sort of transitioned into doing sprinkler systems and like irrigation stuff. So the ute went with him both places. Yeah. But I reckon I was about 6 or something. And there was something about being, maybe it was because it was like freezing at the farm or whatever, but you were warm in the ute.
Yeah.
You're there with dad and like the day is over and it was like a bench seat. Yeah,
I love the bench. Okay, so go back to that little 6-year-old Hamish,
mm-hmm.
is driving up the farm with your dad, mm. with quite a few tools in the car, and call out the words that best describes how that little boy is feeling when you're kind of reclaiming one of your early happy memories, right? Mm, so happy is obviously a word. Try and find.
I think I just liked it because it was, there's a sense of belonging.
Yep.
Like you were part of, we were doing something together.
Yep.
And you were, there was a belongingness to it. There was a camaraderie, I suppose, because it was just me and him.
Yep.
Kind
of a connection, camaraderie.
There was, I mean...
This is great.
I was physically... this is an emotional, but I remember you were physically warm because the farm was freezing, so it was nice to be back in a warm car with Dad. But I guess more this that feeling of, like, you've a satisfaction in like the day's done, because I think it must have been going home, because it felt like we're going home, you know. So you've done whatever you had to do at the farm. It was cold, it was wet, it was muddy, but you did it, and you're back in the car and it's warm, and you're happy. So there's a sense of achievement. We've been through a struggle. He's probably struggled more than me, but I've made it through the day and we're back, you know. It's that feeling of the end of adventure. End of adventure glow.
And on the way up, it would have been an adventure,
yes,
you would have been excited and so forth. And yeah, you know, it's fascinating. I've obviously done that exercise thousands of times. Ask someone what's one of their really happy memories, right? And it might be, you know, going on a family holiday, going up the farm with your dad. It might be climbing a tree, grandparents' farm, whatever it is, opening presents on Christmas morning kind of thing.
Mm.
And the 5 territories that constantly show up, right, all over the world is, well, happy, obviously. The second one is excited or going on an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is free or carefree.
Yeah, or it's a day out of the norm.
Yep. Which is tapping into spontaneity, which is something I want to talk to you about. The fourth one is what you just said, kind of a sense of belonging or warmth or
safety,
as per Sally. And the fifth one is loved.
Yeah.
And I had a psychiatrist ask me in London a couple of years ago, he goes, Ben, why do these same 5 territories keep showing up? Like when you do this exercise all the time.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know, it's above my pay grade, but maybe, just maybe at its core, that's who we are.
That's what living's about.
Before
before
we become teenagers and get pimples and think we have to fit into someone else's ideal.
Yeah.
The amazing thing about that exercise is you can show up right now from that place. If you tap into, because in that memory, you didn't have to do anything, did you? You didn't have to prove yourself to your dad or anyone else. You could just be happy and
that's
excited.
True. It's a memory and it's a moment where you're just being, you know, you have quite happily, anything that needs to be proved has been proved or it doesn't need to be proved.
Totally.
You're just happy being.
Yeah.
Going straight through here.
Now, if I asked you to find another happy memory and then another one and then another one, guess what would happen? Those same words would start to emerge. Like there'd be this consistency of language and he just goes, you know what, that's actually who I am.
The other thing that makes me think of is we can, you know, because I'm a parent of small-ish kids, sort of, you know, 5 and 10, 5 and 9, you can always, that, like you said, you can create that today.
Totally.
You can create those moments today. You can easily hit 3 out of 5, 5 out of 5 on the way home from school, like with half an hour in the afternoon,
totally.
You can hit that.
Yeah, yeah. So literally all the work we do is trying to find a set of words or mantras or affirmations that just kind of reminds people of who they are, like the human being, right? Not the human doing. So if I asked you to do it, okay, before you write a to-do list for the day, you write a to-be list for the day, right? Okay. And if I said to you, off the top of your head, right, what kind of human does Hamish want to be for the rest of his life?
Yeah.
Right? Just off the top, what kind of words would you say? Do you want to be playful or grateful or kind?
I would put kind. I'd put kind at the top of that list.
Yeah.
Because I think you know, there's a lot of different ways you could interpret that word, but to me, kindness would be a willingness to, you know, to, especially when I'm thinking about who do I want to be with my kids that day and my wife that day, which is, you know, the predominant important relationships.
Yeah.
You want to show up selflessly. I think there's a big selfless component to kindness.
Yep.
And that's probably something that I think we all struggle with, but that gets in the way of my day.
Yeah.
Where you just get a bit lost in what you need to get done.
Yeah.
But true kindness, I think, is, you know, it's giving for the joy of giving, and it's being there and available and safe and not dragging any of your other issues into it. So for me, that would be sort of top of the list. And then it's an act of love too. So it's loving and kind would be, I reckon, that would be tussling for top spot.
Love and kindness. Yeah, beautiful.
And then I reckon that maybe hot on the heels of that, once you've established that, you want to be, I always try and, you know, more and more as I get older, I think about how to be a good leader. In the family too, when and co-leading us with Zoe always, but for the my leadership roles in my family, I think again a good leader, like to me again leadership, like loving leadership, is those things where it's kind and it can create fun and it can create chances and opportunity in places where maybe. You know, if the team's spirits are down, you can be the person that slightly refocuses where we want to go for the day and help keep the vibe up.
Yep.
And so for me, being a good leader, if I can start the day and finish the day feeling like, all right, I want to be a good leader for the kids today and for Zoe today. It also is someone that takes the initiative too. Like I think, you know, I don't think I'm lazy, but maybe I dance with that. I dance with the occasional moment where you just like you're happy to just sit and go, oh, all right, things are fine, and like kind of let. But I'm also ferociously aware of the limited amount of minutes and hours and days we have, and so the other side of that dance is me being like, no, like what can we be doing now? What little bit of effort can you be putting in now that will pay huge dividends in the future? Like, can we be thinking, like, even like you said, like walking the dog, like even simple things, like, can we just get out of the house, get moving, don't have a plan, but can we just, I find anytime you can be the person that initiates in a kind and loving and fun way, a bit more doing and a bit more momentum, it pays dividends too. So
beautiful.
I see that as a bit of my role. A good day is where I've successfully initiated that stuff.
Yep.
And maybe a day of missed opportunities is one where my focus wasn't there.
Got it. So you've got loving and kindness on one lens. What else do you need to tap into in order to make tough decisions or to be authentic or so forth? What other words would you need to have in your repertoire? Because you've had a career where you've kind of gone out of your comfort zone quite a lot, right? And tried a lot of new things. So in terms of...
Well, I do think adventure is part of that. And I suppose when I talk about leadership, I'm like, oh, well, it'd be great to kind of lead the family into different adventures and experiences.
So what is that, brave or courage? Or what kind of human do you want to be in order to be adventurous?
I would say daring.
Yep. I love that word.
And maybe just daring in the sense, not that you need to do dangerous stuff, but daring in the sense that you are, again, dancing with fear and nervousness. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think they've ever, you know, I've had a life where I'm in a professional career and probably a personal life too, where I've been lucky to have punch through it, fear a few times, and you find out that on the other side of that is all this great stuff. But yeah. It still gets in the way all the time.
Oh, totally.
So I think you've got to be daring, like to remind yourself that, like, yeah, well, you know, you're going to be hesitant or nervous about things or worried about what other people will think. I still face that all the time. But you have to kind of consistently be daring to punch through that membrane.
Yeah. You could almost simplify life. Well, on your to-be list, right? You've got love, to be loving, to be kind, and to be daring. Yeah. Yep. If you just did those three things and devoted your life to those three things, my hypothesis is for any human on the planet, as long as we have a balance between two extremes, and you just called them out beautifully, one is love, and which kind of fulfills this need for attachment that every human has. And the second one is the need for authenticity, to have the courage to be daring to live a life true to ourselves.
True.
And push ourselves out of our comfort zone.
Let's just shoot down to the beach.
To follow, you know, the possibilities of what we can do with our lives, right? And I think we're all desperately in need, and our kids are desperately in need of those two extremes. You know, yes. The courage to put yourself out of the zone, but at the end of the day to realize that, well, to be considerate that it's not actually about you. It's the impact you can have on someone else. And if you can be kind and loving, you've kind of got those two ticked, yeah.
Oh, man, it's not about you is actually a mantra that I picked up a few years ago for parenting. Like, I was speaking to a friend of mine who is a psychologist, but yeah. he was telling me in his early days when he was seeing patients, he'd struggle with this, and he would go into the bathroom and look at himself in the mirror and just repeat, "It's not about you," over and over again until he could make himself laugh. To snap out of it. And I was like, that's actually a great trick for parenting, but I think for life too. And there's definitely been times where I've found myself just getting, you know, you're getting caught up in the whirlwind of home stuff, and yeah. You just have to be like, it's not about you.
As a mantra for life, you know, that's the number one reason people struggle with public speaking or presenting, right? You talk about your profession, yep. Right? The number one reason people fear that they get wrong, and it's also about leadership, is that they think it's about them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And when you get up on stage, it's got nothing to do with you. Yeah. It's about them. It's about the audience. It's about educating or inspiring them, making them laugh, helping them learn something. And as soon as the incredible thing about that shift is you lose ego, you lose fear, totally. And you lose identity. As long as you've done the preparation and training of whatever the message is you want to say.
Make it all a Q&A. I've tried. Doesn't go well.
You can wing it once, maybe. go lefty.
Go lefty. Yeah. Now we're Bondo. We just cut a few laps.
Yeah.
Cutting laps with Crowley. That's the name of it.
There you go. That's your homework, by the way. By the end of this drive, you have to come up with the name of this.
Okay, nice.
Whatever the hell we're creating here. But it's the same with leadership. The reason most leaders struggle is because they think it's about them. They have to have the answers.
Yes.
As opposed to, well, your only job, similar with being a parent, is to create an environment for them, for others to be successful.
And I think that's a huge thing that I've learned, even over the last couple of years. Well, actually, even recently, like doing a podcast about parenting,
yeah.
About fatherhood. That's one of my main takeaways that I've got from doing that show is ways to, you know, or how often I'm sitting there thinking about like what I'm meant to be doing as a dad,
yeah.
And whether it's like lessons you're trying to impart practices yeah. And structures you're trying to set up, and how often it comes back to that, like, just already that's a thinking error because you're thinking about yourself and what you're doing and how you're doing it,
yeah.
And how often it comes back to stopping and listening to your kid. And the more you can try and get into their world and think about what they need and how they can solve something themselves, or even how they can just talk and express themselves and have someone listening who's not waiting to just tell them a lesson.
Yeah.
So much of it melts away. Like, so much of it comes back to that. And all the best examples of the dads that I speak to, all the bits where I'm like, oh my God, that's great dadding.
Yeah.
I think they share that in common a bit, where it's examples, and there's thousands of different ways to do this, but it's examples of where these men are forgetting what they're trying to do and just listening to their kids and responding to their kids as the unique and original little people that they are, because that's what they are. Rather than trying to create a framework that they're trying to jam their kid into and getting frustrated when their kid's not going into that. So I'm definitely guilty of thinking, you know, oh, I've got to be doing something a certain way. Or you even hold like beliefs from when you, before you've even had kids, about it. This will be a, like a great way to, I'm going to do this with my kid.
Yeah.
And if it's not suiting your kid, like you just got to, you do have to let that go. Yeah. And, it, and being in their world, but being receptive to their world, I think is a, totally. Huge, a huge result.
Where did you learn that from? I mean, my take in, Everyone, absolutely everyone has a philosophy of life.
Yep.
We just don't realise we have one.
Yep.
And the one we don't realise we have gets shaped from our childhood experiences, yep. right? And our families and our schools and our friends. And so literally that philosophy that you just described where it's not about you,
yep.
where did you learn that from? Was it luck or design or...
Good question. I think I'm lucky to know... I think a lot of it maybe I learned in my adult life. And I'm lucky to know good people that think that way or have yeah. helped show me.
And shaped you.
And shaped me, because without wanting to throw my parents under the bus here, I distinctly remember being as an early teen and in my teen years, that feeling of going, oh my God, like, and this is probably a really common teen complaint, but like, they're not listening, they don't get it. But, and they don't seem to want to get it. They don't seem to want to take a knee and understand what's going on in my world.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time, I even wrote a document, which I have still got somewhere, where I was like 14, which I was like, things I will never do when I'm a parent. Like, or like knowing that I was 14 and I had access to a 14-year-old's brain, I was like, I'm going to write down now what I would like my parents to do.
Yeah.
So I can remember this for later and be that kind of person, because that's what a 14-year-old needs. And so I think like I was thinking little, of, I think I was thinking
body
about
experience
it.
Almost.
Yeah, maybe yeah. to just be like, well, let's project. And so I was thinking, I remember thinking of it from a young age. So maybe again, with all love and appreciation to my parents,
yeah.
I think it's one of those ones where you grow up with a philosophy that is a little bit the inverse maybe of what you experience, because you're like, okay, I'm going to try and change that.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. My kids are little. The rubber hasn't hit the road yet, so we'll see how I go.
Okay. We'll go for a drive in 10 years'
yeah,
time.
Yeah, that's it.
If he's off with food poisoning again, it's going to be a constant thing.
I know, you're just driving me straight to the police station.
yeah. Let's talk about your career. How did you get into your career? Was it luck or
bit of luck, bit of design. I think in the entertainment industry, there is no set path. Like, you yeah. can't go around and talk to everyone that's like a stand-up or on radio or on TV and no one's done the Bachelor of performing comedy, and like it just doesn't work like that. So everyone kind of needs an element of, I think where it starts at is like, is a dream with no strategy.
Yeah.
That's pretty common, I would say, if you went yeah. across our industry.
Yeah, that's what dreams are.
Yeah, yeah. Like just a dream with no strategy, but the dream of doing something in the realm of entertaining people was enough to keep you going. And then I think with that mindset, you really just, you know, you never know when an opportunity is going to flow down the pipe or what that opportunity is going to be. But I think we, you know, this, like early on, like when Andy and I started doing stuff, we were just like, let's, you know, we got no reason to say no to this stuff. Like, I think we were, the best thing that ever happened to us was fostering an attitude of just favoring a yes over a no to see what happened.
I love that.
Because we were just young enough to make, knew we were still young enough to make mistakes. Probably an advantage of getting into a game early was, well, even though it feels really real now, we know we're only like 24, so let's just, at some point, you're always really cautious early on, I think everyone is, but at some point, you just can't wait for the perfect thing to come along. You just have to start doing stuff.
Yeah.
Because that is how you, flying hours is actually all that matters.
Practicing, but you also just define the number one rule for opportunity. Say yes more than no.
That's it. That's it. And then I think, and then gradually as things start to take shape, then you can start getting a little bit careful with no's.
Yeah.
And then, because then you realize, oh, actually not doing bad things just as powerful as doing a good thing. And you just begin to get a bit more of a balance. But certainly early on when you're peddling, you know, I'm a big fan of the saying, pick the option that creates more options. So...
pick the option that creates more options.
So I no, yeah, no
opportunity.
Yeah, like when you come up to a fork in the road, like no one's going to go.
Speaking of which, this is a fork in the road.
Actually, ironically, okay. just going to that end. Have a turn left. You know, like let's say a thing comes up, you're like, oh, well, you know, what if it goes badly? It will be, you know, everyone will be a laughing stock. What if it's shit? That's true. That's, I suppose, a semi-legitimate fear, because that's just trying to be careful about your career choices. But at some point, if you just keep saying no to those things because you get very good at imagining the worst case scenario, no one's coming up to you going, hey man, heard about all those no's you've been saying. Well done. Like, we're huge respect. Way to not take a leap. Like, you just, no one's going to know who you are as the guy that said 100 no's.
Yeah.
So eventually you got to do something. You got to get in there and start swimming. And I really credit Ando. You know, I'm eternally grateful for being shoulder to shoulder with him. He does have sort of helped bring that out in me, yeah. too, that you feel a lot more gung-ho when you're in it with a best mate.
Yeah.
And definitely that added to my confidence.
Yeah.
For us to, because suddenly it created a world where if it went terribly, we could laugh about it with each other.
Totally.
If you're by yourself, the world feels a lot bigger and scarier, and yeah. I get that. So maybe through a lack of bravery, I was like drawn to doing it with a friend, but I'll take that trade because I'm not sure. I don't know what would have happened otherwise.
Oh,
so.
Totally. But I'd also argue that no one in this world can do anything in this world on their own.
Yeah.
Like, we all need people. Now, whether you have a career with that person is somewhat irrelevant, just the idea of, well, you might have just fed off his energy. The fact that you were like-minded might have
we
been...
We did.
That was luck more so than design.
And it got us in it, you know? It got us pedaling and swimming and... I don't know why comedy's a triathlon, but that's what it got us pedaling, swimming and running, and we were all... And then like, it began. And you kind of just have to begin, you know?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
And I'm so glad we did.
Yeah, everybody gets into the... If you had to throw a stab in the dark as to why people say those 100 no's, what do you reckon it would be? Why people would say no all those times rather than yes?
I think because when you're starting out, I mean, it's fear, of course it's fear. And it manifests as you can trick yourself into thinking you're making the right decision because the fear is making you say, no, just, you know, wait for the perfect.
Yeah, too much at risk.
Wait for perfect.
Yeah.
And you just, obviously, you know, when you get a bit older, you're like, oh, perfect was never coming because you didn't deserve perfect. Fairly good was going to be always the option. But you can trick yourself into thinking you're doing good work by waiting for perfect.
Yep.
And I think you're actually just scared.
Yeah, and getting back to fear and how you defined dreams.
Yep.
Just before dreams, you know, dreams without any fears.
No strategy.
Without a strategy.
We sort of didn't do the first thing we did going, okay, by the way, you know, in 8 years' time, then we'll be on drive radio or whatever.
Yeah.
You just were trying to do the next thing. It was always a very, very short horizon. Of course, once you look back at a 10 or a 15 or a 20-year career, it has the... I think it's a fallacy, but it looks deliberate. Like, it looks like intelligent design, but it was just evolution. Like, something had to happen, and those were the things that happened.
You know, having traveling the world the last 15 years doing what I do, my hypothesis is the human race, we've lost the art of dreaming. We've lost the art of dreaming, and dreaming big, right? We'll do it a little bit, but... and I think it's also fear. You know, similar with play, and I'll talk to you about play in a sec, but the opposite of play isn't work. The opposite of play is fear.
Yeah.
And I think it's the opposite of dreams as well.
Yeah. I think it's the opposite of love too. I think fear's a pretty good wild card opposite.
Totally, yeah.
And I do agree. Because I think for some reason, like we still have imaginations, but I guess like fear is what happens when the imagination's put to evil use rather than good use.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to fantasize or to conjure up the worst case scenario that's going to happen.
Yeah. Listen to your bad wolf rather than your good
wolf.
That's it.
Like, it's very persuasive. And again, I'm not immune to this. I fall for it all the time. But.
Now, you used the word daring, which was one of the world's most famous speeches that almost every athlete that I work with has, the daring greatly speech. I don't know if you've seen it or...
Who does the daring greatly speech?
Theodore Roosevelt. And Theodore Roosevelt...
Oh, is it Man in the Arena?
Man in the Arena.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. I love Man in the Arena.
Yeah, that's like it's not the...
I keep meaning to print it off for the kids at home, but then also putting a little woo in it, like, just because I want my daughter to look at it too and go, what about the woman in the arena? The notion, of course... Yeah, love Man in the Arena.
Oh, just the relevance of it, and even to today, like, it's not the critic who counts, right? Because
that's
in your world...
I mean, I have to remind myself that all the time.
Yeah.
In the current world, that's like, it's not the person in the comments section that counts.
Yeah. It's Quincy Jones's famous mantra, not a shred of my self-worth is dependent on your acceptance of me. And he used that to overcome, like, the critics and in the industry and so forth.
And even the idea of a critic is a funny notion, isn't it?
Yeah, critique. We've got opinions and judgments. And
that's going to be my job. And that's the thing, like, I love the Man in the Arena because it's, you know, it conjures it up perfectly because you're looking at a dusty, sweaty, you know, cowboy.
Yeah.
And a bunch of people sitting around.
Yeah.
And before I actually heard that speech, my version of that, or what we'd always talk about, was like, well, you know, there's two types of people in the world. There are people that are making things, and then there are people that are talking about people that are making things.
Yeah.
And even though it can be a little lonelier and you get a lot of shit hung on you sometimes if you're in the first category, I think I'd still much rather be in the first category, people that are making things.
Totally, totally. By the way, I did hear recently someone say there's two types of people in the world. Those who divide the world into two types of people and those who don't. Yeah. So at least I know which one you are.
That's it.
Looking back on your career, on the basis you can only join the dots looking back, were there any crucible moments, you know, life-altering, good or bad, or people that kind of shaped your life?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so many little things at the time, like anyone's story, really. Yeah. Little things then ripple into big things.
And you might not have known them, right? In terms of role models, there might have been bits of comedy that you loved as well, as much as...
Absolutely. Yeah. And you also have that weird time dilation when you're in your 20s, where a lot of this happened, like in the early 30s, where you're like, you just expect, oh yeah, this flood of stimulus and things and people will just keep going forever.
Yeah.
And it's not really till I got into my 40s, you're like, I don't know, it's like a pretty finite amount. And the things that happen then are really defining. Like, it's not just going to go on forever.
Totally.
It's a real solid period. And so defining, like, you know, obviously meeting Eddie was the defining moment.
Yeah.
Because that was so much of what came up. That was just the ultimate sliding door.
Yeah.
And
you weren't looking for Andy per se. It was,
and in fact, when we first met, the first sort of creative thing we did together was I entered a stand-up competition to win, I was trying to win $500. And there was like a university stand-up comp. And knowing nothing about stand-up, I just started writing some stuff, and then it was Andy, and then he was like, yeah, we'll come up to my house and, like, we'll run material. And that was probably the first creative thing that we ever did.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, we weren't like, let's form a duo.
A duo, yeah.
It wasn't sort of till a few years later that we, that just sort of emerged. We just generally go left here.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just doing some general leftness.
Yeah.
So that would be a big one. Then there's always the first, and I don't really remember them, but there's the first time you step into a TV studio, or there's the first time that you're on a big camera.
Yep.
With like a paid cameraman behind it, as opposed to being on a small camera with a guy from uni that you know. Like, that's a transition. And
that's not a knife. This is a knife.
Yeah. Then there's like the first time where someone that's your hero is talking to you on a, like, an equal, or like you're on a show.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, like an Adam Hills, for example. Like, I did a lot of episodes of Spicks and Specks back in the day.
Yeah.
And that thing where you're talking and you can suddenly see in Adam Hills' eyes, like, he's listening to you. Like, you're like, oh my God, he's got that face on. Like, he's listening to one of these guests. And you're like, oh my God, I'm the guest.
Yeah.
And so there's that surreal...
You felt like you belonged? Or...
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it's that surreal crossing of a boundary.
Yeah.
And without wanting to sound arrogant, you do feel like you belong to some extent.
Yeah.
You're still scrappy and struggling.
Yeah.
But gee, it's a pretty amazing feeling of you know, knowing that you're flexing the muscle that that has always been inside you, and that's been, you know, that has been waiting to come out.
The spark kind of guy.
You're kind of honouring the spark inside you.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that you wasn't great at it or whatever, but you're like, man, I'm so lucky to be here, at least getting a chance to do this, to perform in this world that I love.
So tapped into gratitude and almost appreciation rather than
totally.
Fear and expectation and so forth.
Totally. And do you know what? I wasn't a super confident kid.
Yeah.
There weren't really many areas of my life I could point to pre-20s where I would say I was, like, supremely confident. You know, like, I didn't really play sport as a teenager. Like, you know, we did, like sport at school, but... Mm. I was never, like, talent. It wasn't a big part of my life. So I didn't actually know that feeling of being, like, capable. And, like, it's what I imagine pro athletes feel like. What a rush. Totally. Where you're like, hey, I'm actually so confident in my abilities that I would like the ball.
Yeah, yeah, give it to me. Yeah, yeah. Pass your mark, put it in my hand.
Yeah, I was not familiar with that feeling. Certainly not in a sporting context.
Gotcha. So we call that potential, tapping into the possibility of what I can do with these skills.
Yeah, and the excitement of... Like, to me, that is such a funny concept. To imagine myself on an AFL field with, like, grown men going, chuck me the ball, like, as if I would have... Like, that to me seems like a ridiculous idea.
Yeah.
But in a performance situation where we need to extract a laugh, definitely would like the ball.
You wanted the ball.
And it's the first time I really ever felt that. Yeah. And that, I think that was the exciting feeling. Doesn't mean, again, we've seen a lot of people get the ball and not do great stuff with it. So it doesn't mean I was good with the ball. Just for the first time, you were excited to have the ball.
On that point, comedy is literally almost the ultimate invulnerability, right? Because your job is to make people laugh. Yeah. Entertain them in some way, shape, or form. So how do you deal with that in real time, the difference between anxiety and excitement? Because they're kind of two sides of the same coin. How did you deal with it?
I think I definitely, you know, and I make sure I say this to my kids all the time too, because now public speaking is like a big part of primary school.
Yeah.
I would still get nervous and, you know, apprehensive and you know, there was still a lot of nerves, but there still are before you perform. And so there is that anxiety. I think you just learn to be okay with it. Like, I always think of it as a dance. Like, you learn to accept it.
Mm. Acceptance, that's a big one.
You just accept it.
Accepting all the things that can go wrong.
Yeah,
the
I think
things
you just,
you can't control.
That's it. I think you just, my literal internal monologue is like, oh, well, here's the fear, and we were expecting it, so no surprises.
Yeah.
I think all that comes with experience is you just don't get surprised by it. Maybe that's the thing. If someone gets up to speak for the first time ever in front of an auditorium of people and then they suddenly get really nervous, I would say that's really normal to get nervous. But the thing that that probably throws them isn't the nerves, it's the shock of the nerves.
Yeah.
Like, it's the surprise of going, uh-oh, I'm getting nervous. Now this is going bad, and it wasn't... I didn't want it to go bad, and now it is going bad.
Yeah.
And because they were surprised by the sensation. So the longer you do it, I don't think you get any less nervous.
Yeah.
You're just not surprised by it anymore.
Yeah.
And so it allows you to move on to the next part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And then in terms of making people laugh, you know, it is a strange one, because it's just something I've always enjoyed doing. And it's a puzzle. It's a little puzzle, you know. Every moment, especially when you're in an unscripted environment, every moment is a little puzzle. It's like a little kind of Sudoku you have to solve. Or maybe you can, maybe you can't, but you should have a go at it.
So the curiosity...
To see if there's a funny thing in this moment that we can extract out of it. And I enjoy the race to see it as well. I like... You know, there's a speed element sometimes in comedy.
Yeah.
And I love seeing people do it really fast. Like athletics fans love watching fast runners.
Yeah.
There's love watching comedic minds work fast. And I enjoy, you know, having a go at it myself.
Yeah.
And that's the funnest thing to me. So it's more, I suppose it's more of just an activity that I enjoy. Or it's slightly addictive. I just can't not do it, unfortunately.
Yeah. As a live therapy session we're having, the principles of what you just tapped into, which I'm guessing and I'm quickly learning is a superpower if you didn't realize, is curiosity.
Mm.
The reason your greatest growth comes from your greatest challenges is because you can tap into humility. It's not about you, but more importantly, curiosity. Okay.
Yeah.
And curiosity turns adversity into possibility, but also removes the cortisol, the fear that you get, oh shit, I'm drowning here, into dopamine, this pattern recognition the aha drug. Okay, how do I get through this? How do I move forward and so forth?
Are they very closely related? Is there a gland that gives out dopamine and cortisol, and you can line ball it and suddenly you got a dopamine instead of a cortisol?
Well, yes, it's called perspective gland.
Okay, that's it for part one of this episode of Car Chats with Hamish Blake. To access video highlights from this episode, download the Mojo Crow app, where you'll find a whole world of stories and helpful content to help you navigate life, including our free perspective intervention, which is a short form exercise designed to help you flip your perspective in real time. Head to mojocrow.com/membership to find out more.